the controversial law and its consequences for minorities in France is the topic of this episode of your Spotlight. Joining us now for our program is Mahmoud Rafat, international relations expert, joining us from Paris. And Mr. Abiyomi Ezekiwe, researcher and political analyst, joining us from Detroit, Michigan.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to the program, to our spotlight here, to the both of you. I'm going to start with you, Mr. Abiyomi Ezekiwe. We've seen minorities in France, sir, screaming racism and systemic violence by police for years, mostly Muslim citizens or those of African descent. Your initial thoughts on how pervasive you think the problem is and what authorities you feel in France have done to address it?
It is pervasive. And according to statistics that have been released over the last several months, dozens of people have been killed by the French police over the last several years. Last year, there were over 20 people who were killed. There were others who were wounded as well. And I don't think the residents of France would be up in arms about this if it was not a serious problem. We saw just 2 months ago mass rebellion demonstrations in several cities, not just Paris, but all across France, in response to the brutal police killing of Nahil, who was of North African descent. So I think this is a serious problem in France, and if the government does not address it, it's going to deteriorate even further.
Thank you, sir. And Mr. Mahmoud Rafat, welcome to the program, sir. Your initial thoughts on how demonstrators, we know they're taking particular aim at this particular law that came into effect in 2017, the 435(1) of the Internal Security Code, which extends the possibility for forces of law and order to shoot in the event of a simple suspect's refusal to comply. Your initial thoughts on this law that protesters are going after and the fact that it's targeting mostly black French citizens and those of Arab descent?
Well, in order to understand the French police functioning, we need to go back to the history, to the French Revolution. The French Revolution, which is shaping the face of actual France, was launched severally and with police and security mentality. And from here, and according to that, even cities of France were constructed in order to liquidify or to make easier for police to be liquid in the cities and to surround manifestations. When you see majority of cities, and let's take example Paris, you will find Paris as main circle, main roundabout, which is the center plus the Châtelet, and from here the avenues to go through, and each avenue is to end by another roundabout, and each roundabout other avenues to go through, and so on. This construction of the cities reflect lots of, or the biggest part of the French mentality. I mean, the governance of France since more than 200 years, since the French Revolution. It's to make the police dominant at any time. That means using the force, depending on this force in order to oppress manifestations. And that made big accumulation and big heritage until we reach it today. Well, in 16th, 15th, French police had also big waves. of movements or and actions that were subject of media. And until today, we are talking about throwing Algerians in the Seine River until today. Something happened more than 6 years ago, almost. But today, it has been legalized. These actions have been legalized by the code itself. The law, and with years, laws, especially under the administration of President Macron, the police was given lots of laws to protect its violence and brutality, and praise of rules and praise of the European Union rules in general. By the way, the European Union has a code of ethics for the practice of the police and has rules to be applied on all European countries, mostly only France, who is somehow outside of this of these rules because of guarantees and protections were given by laws to the French police. Again, the French police, to understand that, we need to understand the whole construction of France and the French Revolution, which shaped the actual face of France we have physically on hand.
Thank you, Rifat. Mr. Rifat. That's a very interesting perspective, and that takes us way back to France's colonial past. Mr. Ezekiel, this IGPN, the Inspector Responsible for Investigating Police Misconduct, released its annual report on use of force by officers. It found last year 38 people died as a result of police action. 22 were shot dead. From those 22, 13 involved cases of someone refusing to comply with a simple police order, most of them Black and Arab descent. Now, there were three such killings the previous year in 2021 and two in 2020. Your thoughts on where this trajectory is headed?
It illustrates clearly that the situation is getting worse for people of color, poor and working class people in France. In regard to the French Revolution, a lot of the reforms that came out of the revolution were eventually overturned. For example, the abolition of slavery was revoked in regard to the occupation of Haiti. And France fought a long war to maintain Haiti as a colony. They were defeated in 1804. Same situation with their colonies in Africa. Algeria, they occupied for over 130 years. In May of 1945, they slaughtered thousands of Algerians for protesting in celebration of the French victory in World War II, but also calling for Algerian independence. During the revolution between 1954 and 1962, over a million people were killed by the French colonial forces. So they have a history of brutal repression. And now with the economic crisis that exists in France, the police are being utilized as the front line of defense against a crumbling state in France, headed by Emmanuel Macron and the prime minister there as well.
Thank you. And Mr. Rifat, we know that France has a whole lot to say about other countries when they have volatile protests, when they're simply riots. There were riots in Iran. The French president called them protests. And now they're having riots in France because of this law. But you see the French, they're not so vigilant when it's taking place on their own soil, how they label it and how they address it systemically.
Well, this is the norm of the international relations. You know, for example, when the United States oppressed severely the movement of Let's Occupy Wall Street, if you remember that, like one decade ago, it was real violence of international law and guarantees of freedom of speech. And despite that, the American media at that time, I'm just giving the example of the American now, not only with the French, to show it's worldwide exchange when it comes to this point. At that time, American media did not criticize the American police so much. And the politicians did not criticize the police, the American police, so much, despite this the severe behaviors of the American police. The same in France. While when there's crash with a country, with another nation like Iran, No, anything will happen in Iran will be put an image of the end of the world. While let me give you a direct example. American politicians, French politicians, I mean, Occidental politicians have been talking a lot about Chinese behaviors against Muslims and Chinese persecution of Muslims, etc. Despite, just beside China, in India, there is more horrible and more terrific behaviors and adopted officially by the government of Prime Minister Modi. But India is a good friend and good ally of the West. That's why India almost never mentioned in any criticism of that. So this is the norm in the international relations. When something, if you are my friend, I will close my eyes and I will not say anything about what's happening on your land. If you are not my friend, I will try and I will do my best to use the smallest and most minor things can happen in your on your land to give impression that you are a monster, you are giving up the human values, you are breaking the international law, you are outside of the United Nations regulations and rules, etc. So this is the international relation game, which all experts are, or all specialists of international relations are familiar with today. We no longer focus on that a lot. It's just political announcement, which at the end of the day do not help a lot, neither build a real situation or get real benefit more than to be media propaganda.
And Mr. Thank you, Mr. Rifat. Mr. Ezekiel, and to Mr. Rifat's point, if you put a law on the books that is getting this kind of result, is blasted by rights group and is targeting a specific sector of your society unjustly and disproportionately, why do you allow it to persist?
Because obviously they have an agenda to suppress the African and Muslim and working class communities in France. That is their agenda. And it's the same thing in the United States and Britain. All these three leading Western industrialized countries have a similar problem with police misconduct and police brutality. It was quite interesting when the rebellions were taking place in France just several months ago in response to the police killing of Nahil. Macron framed the demonstrations as being a result of juvenile delinquency. He accused the parents of those involved in those rebellions as being irresponsible. Rather than address the underlying social problems that prompt these type of unrest to break out in France, I think it's an avoidance on the part of the French government. They do not want to accept that their society is institutionally racist and that the police are brutal, and they need to be disarmed and they need to be dismantled and reorganized. And the same situation is true in the UK as well as the United States.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Thank you, sir. And I want to put that, Mr. Ezekiel's words to you, Mr. Rifat. If Paris, Washington, and London, they proclaim to be the champions of human rights throughout the world, to try to preach to the rest of us what it means to be equal, just, democratic, they try to teach us all about human rights. But when the impetus has to fall upon their own people, upon themselves, upon their own backyard, why do they have such a hard time keeping it clean?
Well, let me just highlight very important point. Yeah, there was lots of remarks concerning the French police functioning. That's true. But what is making these remarks to appear so much is the nature of the French society, the history also, which is building the nature of the French personality. The French personality is naturally rebel personality, is not obedient at all personality in front of the governments, in front of the governor. It's not obedient society. I do not want to specify another or compare to another societies, but let's say to generally to the north of Europe, more north of Europe and Scandinavian countries. These countries, for example, when you go there, once the governor, the prime minister or the cabinet of prime minister or the parliament or whatever took a decision and there is a new rule, new law to increase the age of retirement, for example, society will be obedient. There is kind of trust between the society and their governor. While the French specificity in Europe, which is very close to Italian, but more in France, we can notice that French society, not obedient, not that submissive in front of its governor. And that highlights a lot and put lots of light on the reactions of the police, how the police behave in France. So that's why the French police is always mentioned in the news, because also of reactions coming from the French society itself. Me, myself, from Arabic origin, I can confirm, yeah, there is somehow some remarks also concerning the and misconduct concerning the discrimination, yeah, but not as much as it's described. The French police is severe and brutal, I guess, all the society, all continents, I guess, in the society. Maybe a little bit more against Arabs or black, that's true, maybe, especially in some areas, in some cities, like in Paris, when we go to Paris, some areas were highly populated by Arabs and Africans, Marseille, some, but this is really minor comparing to the French brutality with against the French manifestations of les gilets jaunes, the yellow vests, for example. They are not Arabs, they are not black, they are real French people coming from French descendancy since hundreds of centuries. And despite that, we saw them being massacred by the police. And we do not have exact numbers of victims, by the way, about victims of yellow vests, for example. We do not have real exact numbers. All numbers are showing are highly doubted by manifestants themselves who witnessed that some of their colleagues even were killed. So the French brutality is against all ingredients of the society, unfortunately.
And that's a really interesting point that I want to put to you, Mr. Ezekiel, because it's like, what came first, the chicken or the egg? For the French personality, Mr. Refaat said, is rebellious against authority in general, and their protests are friendly as a result. But did that come as a result of state violence inflicted upon them by authority to make them rebellious, or did the state become authoritative due to their rebellion nature? Because in the U.S., you have something completely different. You have protesters out that are victims, literally victims of police violence, and you cannot really say that they caused the police to create that violence against them.
Normally, people will not go out and demonstrate and rebel if there's no just cause for their actions. And the point is well taken. The Yellow Vest movement was met with severe repression. At the beginning of this year, unions and the student unions who had rolling strikes that raised the age of to receive full retirement, those demonstrations as well were met by vicious police brutality, and they went ahead anyway, the French government, and rammed through the law even without a vote of the National Assembly. So this does not look good for the French ruling class, and I think that they're becoming more and more exposed. What is going on now in West Africa? They were just ordered to leave Niger. They claim now they're going to pull out. So I think all across the world, people are beginning to see France in a different light, not as the origins or the originators of the French Revolution of liberty and fraternity and so forth, but as a ruling class that is seeking to maintain its hegemony, whether it's in France, in Africa, or wherever else they feel they have national interests.
Thank you. And final thoughts I'm going to put to you, Mr. Refat. You close the program with, if you want to basically track down Mr. Ezekiwe's narrative there and yours, it doesn't seem like French authorities have too much care to address this problem.
Well, there have been lots of attempts in order to modify the functioning of France the last two decades. But these attempts were not successful simply as because the government, the state, did not support them. France is very, very, very concentrated regime. And government doesn't support a project, this project will never see the light one day seriously. It will exist on the media, but it will never be applied on the ground. At the end of the day, every single thing in France is in hands of the governor, of the authorities, the civil society, the NGOs, etc. They exist a lot, but they are exist to express their wishes. But to be applied, it must be adopted somehow officially, on official level. That's why it never been adopted. Meanwhile, the contrary has been adopted, is to give more protection to the police. For this reason, the attempts of making serious reform in the functioning of the French police have been not successful, and I do not expect that to be successful for more 2-3 decades minimum from now.
Gentlemen, thank you both for joining us in the program. Pleasure to check in with both of you. Mr. Mahmoud Refat there joining us from Paris, and Mr. Abiyomi Ezekiwe joining us from Detroit, Michigan. And viewers, that brings us to the end of the segment of your Spotlight program. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll have a look at the verses of chapter Nur, the 24th chapter of the Holy Quran and different commentary points of these verses. Brothers and sisters, let's listen to the 33rd verse.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم وليستعفف الذين لا يجدون نكاحا حتى يغنيهم الله من فضله والذين يبتغون الكتاب مما ملكت أيمانكم فكاتبوهم إن علمتم فيهم خيرا وآتوهم مما لله الذي آتاكم ولا تكرهوا فتياتكم على البغاء إن أردنا تحصنا لتبتغوا عرض الحياة الدنيا ومن يكرهن فإن الله من بعد إكراههن غفور رحيم.
But let them who find not the means for marriage abstain from sexual relations until Allah enriches them from His bounty. And those who seek a contract for eventual emancipation from among whom your right hands possess, then make a contract with them if you know there is within them goodness, and give them from the wealth of Allah which He has given you. And do not compel your slave girls to prostitution if they desire chastity, to seek thereby the temporary interests of worldly life. And if someone should compel them, then indeed Allah is to them, after their compulsion, forgiving and merciful.
Dear listeners, as you were previously with us in the previous couple of programs, we said that this verse talks about two important concepts. The first is the fact that these people who do not find the means to get married, they have to keep themselves chaste. This was the order of chastity that the Almighty Allah gave. The second point is that the point of discussion turned to the matter of slavery. وَالَّذِينَ يَبْتَغُونَ الْكِتَابَ مِمَّا مَلَكَتْ أَيْمَانُكُمْ فَكَاتِبُوهُمْ إِنْ عَلِمْتُمْ فِيهِمْ خَيْرًا. Those of your slaves who seek a writing, you have to write it for them if you know any good in them. وَآتُوهُمْ مِنْ مَالِ اللَّهِ الَّذِي آتَاكُمْ. Give them of the wealth of Allah which He has bestowed upon you. And this is the third part of the verse, which we discussed in the previous episode. وَلَا تُكْرِهُوا فَتَيَاتِكُمْ عَلَى الْبِغَاءِ إِنْ أَرَدْنَا تَحَسُّنَا. You do not have to compel your girls to prostitution when they desire chastity. Do not compel your slaves. لِتَبْتَغُوا عَرَضَ الْحَيَاةِ الدُّنْيَا. Just so you can make a gain in this life of the world, you cannot make them. You cannot compel your slave girls to prostitution. We said that this occasion of revelation of the phrase is Abdullah ibn Ubay, who had 6 slave girls, and he compelled them all to sell their honor for earning money and giving it to him. And this verse shows that people in that time, in the age of ignorance, were so much involved in immoral corruption and deviation. And even after the advent of Islam, some people used to continue their previous acts, but this verse came to put an end to it. But still, we see in many parts of the world, even in different countries who advocate civilization and human rights, that this action is easily seen.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن فيه أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly, the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
So, in the today's life, dear listeners, slavery does not apparently exist as before, but in this so-called civilized world, some crimes are committed which are even worse than the age of slavery. May Allah save the people of the world from these pseudo-civilized men and countries, actually. We thank Allah that such shameful crimes have considerably been wiped out in Iran after the Islamic Revolution. So, it is necessary to mention that the purpose of the Quranic phrase, إِنْ أَرَدْنَا تَحَسُّنَا, when they desire chastity, is not that if women themselves would like to do this evil act, then there is no problem to force them. When there is compulsion to do something, willingness to do it is not meaningful. Reluctance is true when there is lack of willing or tendency. Otherwise, being unchaste and encouraging others to be unchaste is a great sin anyway. So this verse does not mean that forcing them and actually compelling them is allowed when they are willing. So this sentence is for the fact that if the owners of these slave girls had a little jealousy, their jealousy would be hurt. The concept of this verse is that these slave girls, who were apparently at a lower social level, would not like to be unchaste. Why did they go along with this wickedness? And at the end of the verse, as it is the approach of the Holy Quran, the path of return, even in this situation, is not closed to those wrongdoers and those who are encouraged to go back, repent, and atone. So the verse continues saying, وَمَنْ يُكْرِهُنَّ فَإِنَّ اللَّهَ مِنْ بَعْدِ إِكْرَاهِهِنَّ غَفُورٌ رَحِيمٌ. And whoever compels them, then unto them, verily, after their compulsion, Allah will be forgiving, merciful. As we said before, this sentence may refer to the condition of those slave girls' owners who were penitent for their gloomy and evil past, and they were ready to do repentance and edify themselves. Or it also is possible that this verse refers to the women who were compelled and forced to do this unchaste action that Almighty Allah says He is forgiving, the merciful. Thank you for staying with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website, at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always work for me. Worry ends when faith begins.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pourreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Israel has resealed its crossings with Gaza for the Jewish holiday of Yom Kippur, or Day of Atonement. There is pedestrian crossing in northern Gaza, and the Kerem Shalom commercial crossing in southern Gaza will remain shut until Tuesday. The closure of the crossings will only increase the suffering of more than 2 million Gazans who have been under a crippling blockade since 2007. The impoverished coastal sliver already suffers from high poverty and unemployment rates. Experts say that sealing the crossings during Jewish holidays will further complicate the situation and is part of Israel's racist policies against the Palestinians.
We strongly condemn this outrageous move. Israel uses Jewish holidays as a racist excuse to make the people of Gaza suffer and deprive them of their most basic rights. The goal of closing the crossings is to further tighten the blockade, destroy the economy, and to keep the people of Gaza as prisoners in a big prison.
Every year, the apartheid Israeli regime seals the crossings with Gaza for an average of 100 days for Jewish holidays and other occasions, while keeping its crossings with Egypt and Jordan open on the same occasions.
Israel has systematically closed the border crossings between Gaza and Israel, Erez and Kerem Shalom, which has inflicted more hardship and more burdens on the Gaza community. In the beginning of the Jewish holiday, that they closed the border crossings with the Gaza Strip mainly, and they keep it open with other areas, like they keep their border crossing open with Egypt, with Jordan.
Experts believe that only the complete lifting of the inhumane Israeli siege and the permanent reopening of all crossings can end the deteriorating humanitarian situation in the tiny coastal territory.
Israel is suffocating the Gaza Strip with its inhumane policies. We demand the full lifting of the blockade and the permanent reopening of all crossings. Israel aims to harm the people of Gaza, including patients and workers, as much as it can, under any pretext it can find.
Tel Aviv's racist policy during Jewish holidays is considered by many as a grave violation of international laws and norms. Israel says that it will keep the crossings with Gaza sealed during Jewish holidays for security reasons. But human rights groups reject Tel Aviv's argument, asserting that such measures are only aimed at tightening the blockade. Ashraf Shana, Gaza.
Iraq started its war on Iran 43 years ago today. In the beginning hours, Iraqi bombs rained down on military bases and airports of the Islamic Republic. Within a few hours, a retaliatory operation was planned by Iran's air forces, codenamed Kaman 99. A gathering was held in Tehran on Saturday to mark the anniversary of this operation during the Sacred Defense Week.
The Air Force, as a force with rapid reaction capacity, intervened in a critical situation and bombed the enemy's bases. The experts in the world believe that our Air Force is not capable of confronting the enemy, but 140 airplanes carried out this operation, along with other airplanes that took pictures of the enemy's headquarters.
Iraq deployed 192 warplanes to attack 10 bases and airports on the first day of the war. But Operation Kaman 99 destroyed Saddam's ominous dream of conquering Tehran in just 6 days.
This operation turned the Ba'athist forces' dream of conquering Tehran in 6 days into a bitter nightmare. After 3 days, the Iraqi Air Force had no ability to confront the Iranian Air Force. And from here, Iranian skies became safe and the ground for the liberation of Khorramshahr was prepared.
Participants in the event also talked about the West's intervention in the war in support of Iraq.
The Western countries supported Saddam to attack Iran with the aim of destroying the Islamic Revolution. Saddam initially attacked the Air Force because he knew how important they were.
This operation and other operations that took place during the 8 years of Saddam's imposed war against Iran show the strength and solidity of the Islamic Republic, which has been achieved by the committed and expert forces of the country. Tehran.
One year since the fatal shooting of black Londoner Chris Cabba, the British police officer alleged to have shot him in the head has been charged with murder. The officer, who's been granted anonymity by a court order, is known by the codename NX121 and has been remanded in custody, which means he'll stay in jail until his court case, which is due to start next year. Mr. Cabba's killing sparked anti-government protests in the UK and once more shone the spotlight on persistent accusations of British police brutality and institutional racism. The Cabba family released a statement welcoming the news of the murder charge and reiterated their calls for justice to be served.
Chris was so very loved by our family and all his friends. He had a bright future ahead of him, but his life was cut short. Our family and our wider community must see justice for Chris. We welcome this charging decision, which could not have come too soon. Now we await the trial of the firearms officer without delay and hope and pray that justice will be served.
Chris Cabba was unarmed at the time of his killing, caused by a single bullet fired to the head by a police officer as he drove through the south of the British capital. His family have said many times they believe that if Chris was white, the police would have responded differently and that he'd still be alive today.
Supporters say that while the charge is welcome, they must keep the pressure up to ensure some semblance of justice is served to Mr. Cabba's family. Stephanie Lightfoot Bennett's twin brother Leon Patterson was killed in police custody over 3 decades ago, and she's acutely aware of the process families have to go through in their fight for accountability.
In order for justice to be seen, and for the wider public, in order to feel safe with the history of the Met Police and the police in general, we need to keep this pressure up. We need to bring these officers and any future officers to book. The one way we can keep up pressure is to march and have our voices heard. Every last Saturday of October, United Families and Friends campaign march from Trafalgar Square at midday down Whitehall to Downing Street so the families' voices can be heard.
The charge of Officer NX121 will only renew the focus on Britain's security services, from long-standing charges of institutional racism, an epidemic of sexual assaults by police officers, and the ongoing persecution of journalists. Trust in the police force is at an all-time low, and as things stand, doesn't look like it will be restored among the public anytime soon. Issa Ali, London.
Lebanese and Palestinian factions have held an annual commemoration for the Sabra and Shatila massacre in Beirut. The 41st anniversary of the tragic killings was attended by prominent figures and dozens of foreign activists. Hezbollah's Deputy Secretary General declared that it is an honor for the resistance front in the region to support Palestine.
If the Palestinians didn't have determination and a will to fight, no support from anywhere would be beneficial. Some accuse the Palestinians that this is not their fight. Iran is supporting Palestine so that the Palestinian people can liberate their land. Palestinian land is for Palestine and the Palestinians, and it will remain as such. And all the support is only in order to assist the Palestinians to return to their homeland.
After the indoor ceremony, a march to the burial place of the martyrs took many back to the bloody events. Some foreign activists say they come every year to tell the world that they will not forget.
Every year, come here, for don't forget. Because, for example, if I think of 8 September, what happened in New York, all the people speak about this, justo, but nobody speak about this massacre in Sabra Shatila. So we come here every year, and I want to give thank you to the Lebanese people, because in the South Lebanon stopped Israel.
We are here in commemoration of the victims of the massacre 41 years ago. We will never forget. But for the Palestinians, the main thing for the survivors now is to get their rights, both in Lebanon, but most importantly, the right to go back to Palestine, to go back to the land, and to get their freedom. So that's why we are here, to give the people here a support in their long-time fight for freedom and rights.
Relatives of the victims of the massacre filed a lawsuit against former Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon in September 2003, but Belgium's Supreme Court dismissed the war crimes case. Arab activists believe that Palestinians have not achieved anything through diplomatic and political efforts, and they now have no choice but resistance.
Palestinians started in 1965 with resistance, and they will continue with resistance because they have no other option. It's not that they don't want peace. They do want peace. They want harmony in the world, but they are not given any rewards for that. So therefore, they will have to fight. And resistance is the only way.
The Lebanese right-wing Falange militia stormed the Sabra and Shatila towns in September 1982 with the assistance of Israeli soldiers and tanks, which were occupying Lebanon at the time. After 2 days and two nights, around 3,500 people were allegedly killed or went missing. 41 years on the horrendous Sabra and Shatila massacre, no one has been held accountable. The speakers and activists attending the ceremony to mark the tragedy stress that the only means to find accountability is through continuous struggle and resistance. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Allegations of racism rocked the UK's Labour Party again. On the receiving end, one of its own MPs, Britain's first female black member and a lifelong anti-racism campaigner, Diane Abbott. In April, she wrote a letter to the Observer newspaper suggesting Jewish, Irish, and traveler people were not subject to racism all their lives, and that although white people with points of difference suffer prejudice, they have not suffered the same racism as black people. Comments deemed racist and anti-Semitic. The backlash was immediate. She apologized, but was suspended pending an investigation. Yet in an open letter published on X this week, she's accused Labour leader Keir Starmer of trying to oust her from Parliament by ensuring she cannot stand for the party.
As a black woman and someone on the left of the Labour Party, I have unfortunately been forced to reach the conclusion that I will not get a fair hearing from this Labour leadership.
Last year, an Al Jazeera documentary exposed apparent anti-black discrimination and a hierarchy of racism in Labour under Keir Starmer. An example of that, earlier this year, right-wing Labour MP Neil Coyle, who racially abused a journalist and had a sexual harassment complaint upheld against him, was reinstated after only a five-day suspension. Abbott was shadow interior minister under former leader Jeremy Corbyn, who was blocked as a Labour MP over an anti-Semitism row in 2020. We asked former Labour mayor of London, Ken Livingstone, who knows Diane Abbott, for his take.
She's been a committed person challenging all forms of racism and prejudice. And this was nothing to do with racism. I mean, who is an occasion going to make a mistake in something they say or write? But as I say, this was about getting rid of Jeremy Corbyn, and she was one of Jeremy's longest friends and solid supporters.
Some of her other colleagues are saying that Abbott is being thrown out of here because she does not conform to the domestic neoliberal policy and rejects the ongoing UK imperialist ambitions, that she should not have sought to placate the Labour leadership. Instead, they say, she should have stood up for what she believed in from the start, because there was never going to be a way back for her. Saeed Pourreza, London.
C.
supporting young innovators and home to knowledge-based companies developing high-tech industries. Pardis Technology Park is taking major steps in commercializing technological achievements, and the 21st annual meeting of the park this year proudly became the venue for celebrating the accomplishments of a new generation of inventors.
Today, Pardis Technology Park has created a standard environment that allows young minds to flourish. It allows them to pursue their goals. With an area of about 500 hectares, we are home to knowledge-based companies that are saving us hundreds of millions of dollars in imports. Every year on this day, we present a number of new products.
On the sidelines of the event, 12 new products were unveiled, from deep drilling robots and software for simulating drilling operations to granulated food products. High-tech is the name of the game.
The technology that we have developed is quite unique. We have managed to develop the know-how to produce granulated products in pharmaceutical dosage forms. This new technology will allow a predictable and repeatable process, which is essential in the pharmaceutical industry. Up until now, our company has been able to enter the market for food additives. These are actually products that we used to import from other countries, and now I should proudly say that the entire procedure from A to Z is carried out in Iran.
Notable achievements that are even more impressive considering harsh Western sanctions on Iran.
There is something called the willpower of strong people, and today we're witnessing that in Pardis Technology Park. This is what happens when the government decides to support your young innovators. They overcome all obstacles, including sanctions.
Our main activity concerns marketing the products of knowledge-based companies. We mostly focus on the oil and gas sector. However, this year we are also trying to get those products that are competitive into the world market. We have talked to Chamber of Commerce about that.
With efforts made by these young inventors, products labeled Made in Iran will soon be in demand on the global market.
Supporting innovation and new ideas, Pardis Technology Park is looking forward to gaining a foothold in the international market. Gisumish Ahmadi, Tehran.
On the picket line again, up to 60,000 of England's junior doctors. What is different this time? They're joined by 20,000 of their senior counterparts. For the first time, all asking to be paid what they deserve.
We do this with a heavy heart, but our salaries have been falling in real terms for 14 years. My salary in real terms is 35% lower than it was 14 years ago. Unfortunately, the Prime Minister refuses to talk with doctors about pay, and so we've been forced to do this.
Junior doctors are asking for a 35% restoration, while their senior counterparts are asking for an above-inflation pay rise. In July, Prime Minister Rishi Sunak said there would be no more negotiations on pay and that the rise recommended by the so-called independent pay review body was final. Yet this, the doctors say, isn't just about pay. It's about the depressing state of the NHS. Junior doctor Arjun Singh fears for its future.
If you're having people waiting 12 hours in waiting rooms before they're seen by a doctor, if you're having people having heart attacks and strokes in A&E waiting rooms before they're seen, well, that is a system that has collapsed. And the reason that it has collapsed is in large part because we've not funded our workforce properly. We can't retain doctors. You can't have a hospital and an NHS if your doctors are leaving so frequently.
According to the British Medical Journal, 4 in 10 junior doctors in the UK plan to leave the NHS as soon as they can find another job, at home or abroad. But while the trench warfare continues, delayed appointments have reached the 1 million mark, with the NHS's waiting list already at an estimated 7.6 million.
If the government has any hope of these doctors giving up their industrial action anytime soon, then today's double doctor strike should be a sign that that is simply not going to happen.
With both sides digging in their heels, the strikes could continue into another crippling winter. And for patients on the long waiting list, that could potentially mean months of more misery. Saeed Pourreza, London.
Palestinians keep descending further into poverty and de-development under the Israeli occupation. In a report released on Monday, the World Bank said poverty rates are stubbornly high, as roughly 1 out of 4 Palestinians live below the poverty line. Palestinian non-governmental organizations say the poverty is more severe in Gaza.
In Gaza, the situation is more and more catastrophic comparing to the West Bank. Due to the blockade and wars for the 16 years, we have high deterioration on the humanitarian conditions. Also on the economic standards, due to this blockade, we have food insecurity.
They say that the Israeli occupation and blockade are the main culprits behind the increase in poverty among Palestinians. The Abu Ajwa family in Gaza's Zaytun neighborhood, where more than a dozen people reside, their average daily income is only around $5 a day. The abject poverty has forced them to live in miserable conditions.
Look at my house. It is falling apart and we can't afford to fix it. You can't even imagine how hard it is for me or for my family. Our living conditions and those of many families here are disastrous. We can hardly afford to put food on the table. Poverty has taken its toll on us, and I don't see any improvement to our situation anytime soon.
The situation of the Abu Ajwa family is just a small example of how thousands of people live in the tiny territory. Most Gazans are impoverished and rely on handouts to survive as their incomes continue to dwindle. More than 2 million Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have been living under intensified access restrictions since 2007 and are largely isolated from the outside world.
The people who are in need for humanitarian assistance, 80% of the population, and most of them children, women, elders, who are in bad need for such assistance. On time, we are suffering from shortage of funding for humanitarian aid. This will lead for more deterioration in the humanitarian and socio-economic situation.
Daily life is a constant struggle for most Gazans because of the inhumane Israeli practices.
According to experts, the Israeli regime is responsible for the high poverty rate and the near collapse of Palestine's economy, as well as its isolation from the rest of the world. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. As a reminder, in a couple of episodes, we made you familiar with the views of John Foran, American professor of sociology from California University, on the character of the greatest leader of the past centuries, Imam Khomeini. Today, we are going to make you familiar with the views of Fred Holliday, who has made researches on international relations and West Asian issues. Stay tuned, please. Holliday was born in Ireland in 1946 and he died in 2010. He had graduated from Oxford University in 1967 and taught in the years 1985 to 2008 in the College of Economy of London. He was familiar with some languages such as Farsi, Arabic, Greek, Russian, French, and so on. Holliday had traveled several times to the West Asian region for his studies. He was a supporter of Soviet attack on Afghanistan, NATO intervention in Bosnia and Herzegovina, and the occupation and devastation of Afghanistan by the US. Fred Halliday's first book on Iran, titled Iran, Dictatorship and Development, was written in 1978, nearly 1 year before the victory of the Islamic Revolution. His next book, An Introduction to Iran's Revolution, was published for the third time. In the advent of the Islamic Revolution, he traveled several times to Iran. 30 years after the victory of the Islamic Revolution in 2009, he pointed to the results of his unpublished studies in a conference in London, saying that the Islamic Revolution resembled four great revolutions in the world, namely the French, the Russian, the Chinese, and the Cuban revolutions. He tried to justify his claim with the convergence of all groups, Marxist, liberalist, and religionist, under the leadership of Imam Khomeini. The Irish researcher concluded that the revolution in Iran was the most modern revolution in the human history. Halliday also emphasized that the Islamic Revolution was a non-violent revolution. As an example, he mentioned the well